From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made just 1 year ago when something rather crazy happened in the world's forests and fertile plains. Something started killing a vast number of species. It happened rather suddenly. 90% of sea animals have gone extinct, 70% of land animals, and while scientists are not exactly clear on what caused it, they do have some ideas. Now, did I say this happened 1 year ago? I should clarify that it happened one galactic year ago, roughly. That's 250 million years or so. And the event is known as the Great Dying. Never heard of the term galactic year? I hadn't either until I read astrobiologist David Grinspoon's essential new book, Earth in Human Hands, Shaping Our Planet's Future. Grinspoon takes us through the history of life on our planet, along with everything that has threatened it, from the Great Dying to the strike that killed the dinosaurs to our own capacity to deal with near-Earth objects in the future. But that is just a small taste. Grinspoon's book is already being hailed as a vital look at how to evaluate and adapt to climate change. In short, we are thinking too small. We have to think and act like a civilization planning for a long, long existence. The book tackles subjects like geoengineering and includes ideas about what we might learn from looking to the stars for inspiration. I loved it, even if it shook me up a bit, and I want to welcome him now. My guest is David Grinspoon, the author of the book Earth in Human Hands. He gave me several months to read it. I needed it. Thank you, David. Thanks for being patient. It's great to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be talking with you.
Well, the problem with Earth today, you have argued, is that we really only get one. You know, we don't have this luxury of multiple chances to get it right, or, boy, we really did burn too many fossil fuels, or multiple experiments, and time to fix our mistakes. Are we behaving, David, as if we don't grasp that we only have this one shot?
Yes, we definitely are. We have been. If you look at the sort of quantitative record of what human beings have been doing and the activities we've been perpetrating that change our planet, there's a rather disturbing trend. Or if you measure all of these influences we're having on the planet, the atmosphere and the water cycle, the carbon cycle, the nitrogen cycle, you name it, they've all been sort of shooting up off the charts. So if we were to continue those trends, we would quickly reach a point where we were endangering our own tenure on this planet. You know, we're not threatening the Earth. We're not even threatening the biosphere. We're threatening our own ability to persist here. The good news, perhaps, is that we do have this ability to see what we're doing. We have all these Earth observation satellites, and we have, there are some signs, in fact, that some of those curves are turning around and that we have the potential to modify our behavior. And that, that's also a rather unique feature amongst the creatures that have evolved on Earth. And that capacity is one that could be cultivated and should give us some hope.
You have said that, contrary to what some of the really dour voices say about climate change and our cause of that, you know, some people say, human beings are a cancer on this planet. And you said, we're not a cancer. We're living organisms learning sort of to handle what we're doing here. Does it bother you when people say we're a cancer?
Well, I mean, there's a certain truth to it. I've looked at the metaphors we use to describe ourselves, and they're often metaphors of disease and crime. You know, we're a cancer. We're a virus on the planet. We're raping the rainforest, you know, these sort of violent, criminal, diseased metaphors. And, you know, you can see where these come from. There's a certain truth to that. If you look at some of the patterns of our multiplying activity on the planet, there's a similarity to the growth of a tumor. But at the same time, I caution against using those metaphors. I think there are other ways we can describe ourselves, because unlike a cancer, I mean, a cancer doesn't stop and have a conversation and say, hey, maybe we shouldn't act this way. Maybe we shouldn't be a cancer. You and I are discussing this now, and people are listening and having conversations. That is a very uncancer-like characteristic. So I worry that if we can use those metaphors to describe our past, but we should be careful that we don't use them to proscribe our future and sort of assume that we won't change our behavior and kind of set in concrete those patterns, which are not set in concrete.
We're talking to David Grinspoon, the author of the new book, Earth in Human Hands, Shaping Our Planet's Future. I highly recommend it, and I introduced him as an astrobiologist. How long would we have to go back, David, before that term wasn't even a thing anymore? You know, how new is the term astrobiologist, and how do you describe what it actually means?
Astrobiology is the scientific study of the potential for life in the universe. So we study the history and patterns and limits of life on Earth, and we study our growing knowledge of conditions and evolution of environments on other planets to try to understand the potential for the universe to make life in other environments and how we might detect that. As far as how far back it goes, well, it really, in a sense, was born when we started exploring the other planets with the birth of planetary exploration in the 1960s, and people realized, you know, we didn't need to just think about the geology and the meteorology of these planets. What if, you know, what if we were able to find life? And so then it was called exobiology, and it was kind of a fringe thing. NASA didn't really embrace it, but some pioneers, like Carl Sagan and some of his colleagues, said, hey, you know, we want to figure out if there might be life on Mars. And so they called themselves exobiologists. And then it was really in the 1990s that NASA got more serious about this, because we made a number of discoveries that sort of encouraged us to think, hey, you know, there might actually be life underground on Mars or in a subsurface ocean on Europa, Jupiter's moon Europa, or even, you know, now in all these exoplanets we're discovering. So NASA got sort of more serious about this and renamed it astrobiology and started putting some funding into it. And now it's become a worldwide interdisciplinary effort to understand the potential for life in our universe.
You mentioned Carl Sagan. He comes up plenty in the book. Do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about your connection with Carl?
Well, he's a big influence on me. I mean, he's really, Carl Sagan was a big influence on really everyone in astrobiology and I'd say in modern planetary exploration. But I had a personal connection with him growing up as a kid. He was actually my father's best friend. So starting around the age of six, my dad was a Harvard professor, and they were both Harvard professors. And so I grew up calling him Uncle Carl. He was around the house a lot, and this very inspiring person, this cool guy that was friends with my parents, who was into astronomy and helping explore the planets. This was before he was famous, but you know, he was always a very riveting person doing really interesting things, and it definitely helped spark my interest. And then later on in life, when I became a professional scientist, I actually got to work and collaborate with him on some interesting research projects. So he was definitely somebody that influenced my outlook on what human beings are doing here in the universe, and also about how scientists ought to go about trying to communicate with the rest of everyone.
Well, what I loved about Earth in Human Hands is not just the thoughtful look at our history and our potential future, but also the fact that you weave in a lot of narrative. There's a lot of good narrative storytelling here. So listeners, it's actually very easy to read. It's a lot of fun to read, whether it's, you know, the story of exploring a deep crater in our landscape that we would have to learn much more about in terms of what space object caused a planetary impact, or stories about Carl Sagan, things like that. It's just a very easy and enjoyable read. I knew and looked forward to your discussion on, I knew there was going to be a discussion on the Anthropocene. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, by the way. This era that we are ostensibly in, even though it's kind of controversial. So why don't you explain to our listeners the whole debate about, am I saying it right, Anthropocene?
Well, there are a number of debates about this concept, and one of the debates is how you pronounce it. So you hear some people say Anthropocene or Anthropocene, or our British colleagues say Anthropocene. So that's probably the least interesting debate. But the more interesting,
how do you say it?
Are,
how do you say it?
You know, it's the question is, have we actually entered a new phase, a new geological phase or epoch of Earth's evolution? Everyone listening has heard about the Jurassic, the Triassic. You know, the geologists give names to these different layers in the rocks and times in Earth's past. And the idea is that we have now perhaps actually transitioned from the Holocene, which is what we call the epoch since the last ice age, about 10, 12,000 years ago, into a new time that people are calling the Anthropocene, or the age of humans. And the idea is that we have now become such a strong force perturbing the Earth, changing the atmosphere, changing the land surface itself, changing the cycles of water and so forth, that changing the climate, obviously, that we've become a recognizable factor in the geological history of Earth, worthy of a new name for this period. We have become a geological force, and it's controversial to give it that name. Some people say, well, that's arrogant, it's self-aggrandizing. Who are we to name a geological age after ourselves? But in my view, when you just look at the evidence, if you add up all the changes that are happening to the planet now as a result of human influence, it's clear that the Earth has entered a new phase, and perhaps by naming it that way, we're sort of owning up to it, which is the beginning of accepting responsibility and really looking clearly at the role we're playing, which allows us to ask, well, what role do we want to be playing?
The reason I opened the program with a look at the Great Dying was of how interesting it was for me to read. You know, that's something that if you would have asked me what was the Great Dying, I would not have, before your book, been able to tell you too much about it, certainly not when it happened. You know, maybe it comes up in high school classes and buried deep in my own past. But you write in the book, and I just want to touch on this a little bit here because I feel like there are some possible parallels, and I want you to tell us why you kind of decided to focus on this in one part of the book. You write, there are those mass extinctions where life is not so innocent. Biological evolution can also cause catastrophic global transformations. Sometimes life brings disaster upon itself. Recently, some scientists have taken another look at the cause of the Great Dying, the most extreme crisis Gaia has ever experienced. They found that while there was undoubtedly a volcanic trigger, there may have also been a biological bomb. And you go on to discuss what that could be and the implications of that. Tell us about that.
Well, the reason I dwell on this is because people get down on the human species and they say, oh, you know, of all the species that have ever lived, we're the most destructive. That's actually not true. If you look at the deep history of the Earth, there are episodes like the Great Dying and other times in Earth history when life forms have played a role in causing mass extinctions, when the evolution of life itself, when some species is so successful at doing what they do and multiplying, that they change the environment radically in a way that causes the extinction of other species. So in an effort to sort of understand who we are and what we are and what's unique about our time on Earth, I wanted to look at that history. And I point out that, you know, there are species of bacteria that have radically changed the planet. And yet, obviously, something different is going on now. So we can sort of say, well, what have we got that they didn't have? You know, we don't look at them and say, oh, those irresponsible bacteria, how could they have done that? What were they thinking? You know, because they weren't thinking. Right. They were just bacteria. So this is a way of sort of look at, you know, characterizing, giving some perspective on ourselves and saying, okay, well, this is a new phenomenon in the history of Earth. It's not new for a life form to change the planet, but it's new for a geological force to be aware of what it's doing and to have this ability to say, oh, wait a minute, what's going on here? This is not really good for our own future, let alone the future of all the other species. So that ability to self-reflect and to wake up is something that, you know, now people listening might say, well, obviously we don't have enough of that ability because look at what we're doing. But if you look at all this transformation in a geological time scale, you also realize that these might be early days in the human experience, in the human experiment, that we may be now in the beginning process of a sort of awakening and ability to include that knowledge of our global influence into how we act in the future. And that could be the turning point that we're actually, you know, just at the dawning of. And this is the view that I promote in my book, that there's a potentially a hopeful aspect to this realization of how different we are from those other species that have in the past come along and sort of wrecked the planet.
Yeah, I love it. You're right. Those irresponsible cyanobacteria taking the world to the brink of ecocide. Yeah, I love that. And for me, that was a really crystallizing way of presenting that, David. That was very helpful for me because I don't have your background, but very clearly, you know, life as it develops is going to have unintended consequences, but we have this gift. I mean, I take it that you're an optimist, that you feel like this is a huge opportunity. Not that we're on the brink of wrecking things, but we're on the brink of recognizing the gift that we're the first life form that has this self-awareness, that can make the shift. But I want to spend the rest of the hour, if we can, kind of talking about what it would really mean to be an intelligent civilization behaving as if we plan to be here for maybe millions of years. I mean, we talk about long term. We barely even talk about 100 years here. So there's a lot of different ways we can do that. And listeners, if you want to call the program, I'd love to hear from you. It's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. My guest is David Grinspoon, the author of Earth in Human Hands, Shaping Our Planet's Future. He's an astrobiologist. You can find him on Twitter at Dr. Funky Spoon. He's one of the great science communicators out there. And this is a great chance for us to talk about not only climate change, but what we do about it going forward. So what does a long-term timescale, real planning, start to look like to you, David? I mean, we talk about long-term, we talk about 100 years right now. What does long-term planning really look like to you?
So our most immediate task, our near-term task, is to stop the climate vandalism that we're currently perpetrating on the planet. And you know, when you say I'm an optimist, in a certain sense, I am, because I do believe that we can look at what the 22nd and the 23rd century and the 24th century are likely to be like, and I think there's reason to hope that we'll have made it beyond a lot of our current struggles. But I don't want to minimize the challenges that we face in this current century. In fact, I think that we can arm ourselves with that long-term vision of the role that we want to play on Earth, and it will actually help us sort of maintain hope engage in the struggle on the short term. So near term, we have to transform our energy system globally into one that is not wrecking the natural systems upon which we depend. The good news is we are in the midst of that transformation. It's just frustratingly slow right now, and the pace with which we're able to do that will determine how much damage we do and how much pain and suffering and dislocation we cause. So that's our main task, but of course it doesn't end there. Once we get over that, then we can look at some longer term threats, and we see, well, there are asteroids out there that, left to their own devices, will hit the Earth just like that one that hit and killed off the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. But we don't have to let that happen. In fact, now that we know they're out there, and I think we know how to divert them, then it becomes our responsibility, I believe, to protect Earth from that threat. And on a somewhat longer time scale, there's the threat of dangerous climate change that would happen naturally. The Earth goes through dangerous climate cycles on longer time scales. And so again, once we become aware of that and we imagine ourselves being here for many more thousands of years, tens of thousands of years, then we have to have a plan for that. We can't let there be another ice age. That would be more damaging than the climate changes we're facing now. And again, I don't think a civilization that is here for that length of time would have that much trouble preventing that. So we sort of can flip it around from being these sort of teenage vandals to the Earth's climate that we are now, to being the mature adult protectors of the planet. And I think in the long run, we'll be able to save many more species than we're threatening now.
We're going to continue on that in a second, but let me get our first listener question. Emily sends an email with two questions. Emily says, does your guest's book call for a total halt to burning fossil fuels, and does it address the problem of the growing human population and whether it needs to be limited? That's from Emily. So let's take her first question first, David. She wants to know, does your book call for a total halt to burning fossil fuels?
Absolutely, yes. But then, you know, then the question really is, on what time scale? Do I believe we should totally halt burning fossil fuels tomorrow? No, actually, that would be very destructive and lead to, that would be sort of genocide to people that are depending on energy to survive in various locations, and energy, you know, for agriculture and crops. And, you know, but on the other hand, do I think that 100 years from now, we will be completely off of fossil fuels? Absolutely, yes. So some time scale between tomorrow and 100 years, you know, then the real difficult question is how fast. And in my view, we're acting way too slow, far too slowly. But I also see this accelerating. You know, all these alternatives, wind and solar, are getting much cheaper. There is an inevitable, move away. I mean, coal is on its way out, no matter what somebody says in a campaign. It's just not economically viable, and that's a good thing because that's, that stuff's deadly for health and environment. So, the transition is happening, and yes, we need to do all that we can to quicken it. So if I had to answer Emily's question with a yes, no, I'd say yes, I do call for a total halt in fossil fuel use. But the real, it's like going cold turkey from an addictive drug. You don't just pull the patient off it and then they're going to suffer. We have to ease ourselves off it in a smart way and as quickly as we can.
All right, so her second question was on population. We also have a phone call on that, so I'm going to go to Tom in Rochester, and then we'll let David respond to both Emily and Tom. Go ahead, Tom.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just wondering how much do we as a species on this planet really have to start controlling our population, especially in the third world countries and stuff where they're still primarily using fossil fuels and stuff. And, you know, are we going to run out of arable land, water resources? How much, do you think we as a species have to really start controlling our population? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Tom. Go ahead, David.
Well, I mean, it's a great question. He's, put his finger on one of the really key pieces to the puzzle here of human presence on Earth and how we're going to manage it. The more people there are, the more we are straining our natural resources in, all kinds of ways. It's the multiplier by of food and energy and all these things is population and water use. But there's actually good news on that front. The global population is going to level out and start to decline later this century. All of the projections show that. And it's happening for the right reasons. It's not happening because people are starving and, because of war. I mean, all those things are of course, problems. But the main reason population is showing signs of leveling out and decreasing is because of choices that people are making, and in particular, because poverty is declining globally, and the most important factor is when women in poor countries become educated and have more choice of the decisions they make in life, then they tend to have smaller family sizes, and that's happening. Fertility is decreasing and is projected to keep decreasing because of declining poverty and increasing education of girls in poor countries. So we've already passed sort of peak baby, the peak birth rate, and we're projected to pass peak population in, the next generation. So, again, I wish this was happening faster, but there's every reason to believe that population is going to level out and start to decline. And if we're not unlucky with droughts and famine and so forth, we may sort of squeak through that peak of population and be able to feed most of the people on Earth and then get over that bend to that time when we have a more stabilized population. And we have also intensified our agriculture that much more so that we're using less land area to grow our food. And that is really good news for our ability to preserve biodiversity and help out all the other species that we share this planet with.
Thanks for the questions there, Emily and Tom. And you can call the program if you've got a question or a comment for our guest, David Grinspoon. He's the author of the new book, Earth in Human Hands, Shaping Our Planet's Future. And you can call the program 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. They're going to get our only break of the hour, and when we come back, I'm going to read a little bit from the Forbes.com review of the book that talks a little bit about geoengineering. We're going to talk about what that could mean going forward. I mean, in many ways, we can talk about our ability as a civilized and technological species to really shape the world that we inhabit. How much should we be doing that, and how much can we be doing that? We'll talk about that with David and much more after this break. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, the College at Brockport is hosting 175 students and faculty from schools across Europe and America in the world's biggest European Union policy simulation. We're going to talk European politics and populism, recent trends, and more. Then in our second hour, we preview the 2017 Rochester Cocktail Revival. It's all coming up Friday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. From the Forbes.com review of the book Earth and Human Hands, they write the following, quote, Earth and Human Hands really makes you think about the planetary need for and benefits of geoengineering. There are a wide variety of scientists who think about that only as a last-ditch effort to fight climate change when all the ounce of prevention solutions have failed. Yet humans have already had a tremendous effect on our atmosphere, on our land use, on our water cycle, on the rivers, lakes, canals, and bodies of fresh water, on the oceans, and much more. We might not call it geoengineering because it wasn't intentional, but the effects of our collective actions over the past 10,000 years are undeniable. Grinspoon provides possibilities, not all of which will turn out to be solutions, for addressing the ramifications of what we've already done and what we're continuing to do. It's a fascinating problem to consider. End quote. So let's start with geoengineering. How do you define what that really means, David?
Well, what people often mean when they talk about geoengineering is some of these sort of brute force methods of changing climate. One that's often discussed is squirting some stuff into the stratosphere, maybe aerosols of sulfur dioxide or bright dust or something that then will reflect a lot of sunlight and help to cool the Earth. Or another scheme that's often proposed is that we dump a lot of iron filings into the ocean and cause algae blooms, and then that blooming algae will suck CO2 out of the atmosphere and help to solve global warming. So those are what I call the sort of brute force geoengineering methods. But and I am not in favor of implementing those now, because I feel that we're so ignorant of the Earth system that we would be in danger of making the cure worse than the disease. That, yeah, we know we could dim the sun, but what else would we be doing to changing global precipitation patterns, causing drought, changing the ocean ecosystem in ways we don't understand? I think it's a very dangerous approach to try to solve our messing up of the system by further messing it up, in a sense. But I also feel as though if we step back and look at what's happening on the planet, in a way our challenge is to move from inadvertently changing the planet to purposefully changing the planet. We've become planet changers, and I don't think that we have the option to just stop being planet changers, not without radically depopulating the human presence on Earth. And I'm not talking, then we're talking by an order of magnitude, and that's basically, then we're talking sort of genocide, which I don't think most people, at least those in the right minds, support. So I don't feel that we have the option to stop being planet changers. So then we sort of have to think, how do we do it well? How do we do it artfully and thoughtfully and with the big picture, the long view in mind? So then we have to go back to thinking that, in a way, we have to be planetary engineers. And even when we talk about stopping our CO2 emissions, if we do that in a purposeful, globalized way, then in a certain sense, that's a kind of geoengineering. When we thoughtfully change our presence on the planet and change the influence we're having on the climate, which is very much something we need to do, then in a broader sense, that's a kind of sort of more gentle geoengineering. Even planting forests to purposefully draw down CO2, which, reforestation, which I think most of us are in favor of, that's a kind of geoengineering. The other thing I would say is that in the long run, again, when we talk about earlier, we were talking about stopping asteroids from hitting the Earth or preventing another ice age or, some averting dangers that would happen naturally in the future without interference. That's also a kind of geoengineering that I think ultimately we will be obligated to, we will want to undertake. So I think in the long run, we have to think of ourselves as taking a more active, purposeful role in managing the planet to some degree. And that means we have to be planetary engineers. But having said that, that doesn't mean I support the most common schemes that one hears about to sort of quickly and in a brute force way try to fix climate. There's no way around the fact that we have to change our CO2 emissions. That's our number one way that we have to try to fix climate in the near term.
Sure, but when it comes to, for example, avoiding another ice age down the line again, maybe even thousands or tens of thousands of years from now, it's hard for me to envision that without some serious geoengineering, right?
Yes, absolutely. That will require that we undertake some planetary scale engineering. And, you know, it's a daunting thought because we're clearly too ignorant still of the Earth system.
Sure.
To do that now. But that, you know, we have some time to work that problem. We, you know, if you think how long our civilization has been here, you know, roughly speaking, as sort of civilization builders, we've been here on the order of 10,000 or so years. Imagine that we're here for that interval again, that long again, or, you know, another 10,000, or certainly when we're here by 50,000 years. That's the timescale at which we would really have to consider that these sort of dangerous natural climate changes would become inevitable. If we're here for that long, I think we'll know enough. We'll be ready. And that involves learning a lot more about how planets work, about how the Earth system works, and certainly it involves some increased measure of self-knowledge as well, and learning how to deal with ourselves as a planetary entity.
All right, let me get back to the phones. John in Parenton is next up with author David Grinspoon. Go ahead, John.
Well, I think it's very interesting to look at things from a galactic age, and I have to admit I haven't participated or heard of that kind of time frame. But one of the questions I have is we have to do that, to consider like that, we have to try to get to the galactic age kind of time frame. And it appears, just going back in short time frame, a decade or two or maybe a little more, that our models for what's happening to the rate of temperature rise and et cetera keep falling behind, it appears. And I wonder if the author would be interested in it, just if he has an opinion of whether we are approaching the tipping age and this is all a bit... blue sky.
Thank you, John. In other words, have we already reached the tipping point on climate change, David, and is this too little too late anyway?
Well, you know, our models are getting better and better than they were a couple of decades ago, for sure. And they're still, you know, our models pale in complexity against the actual complexity of the real planet that we're trying to simulate. We're getting better, and we are also learning about how good our models are with an increasing amount of data about the real world that we can compare our models to. That's crucial with all these Earth-observing satellites and, you know, the longer baseline of good data that we now have to compare against our models. The question about tipping points is a daunting one. I do not, and this is something I've talked with a lot of climate scientists about, I do not believe at this point we are at or have passed any kind of a tipping point that is pushing us inevitably towards some kind of new climate state that we are powerless to avert. It is something that could happen. One example is that, you know, there's all this methane in these methane hydrates on the seafloor that as the ocean gets warmer, they start to decompose, and that releases methane, which then heats up the atmosphere, which, you know, in the long run makes the ocean warmer and causes more of that stuff to decompose. And if something like that starts to really run away, we could be in real trouble on this planet. I don't believe, to the best of my knowledge, and again, this is something I've read a lot about and talked to a lot of experts about, that we are at one of those tipping points. But we cannot guarantee that we won't hit one of those in the next century or two centuries. And that's part of the reason why there's a great amount of urgency in our ability, in our need to change our energy system and stop this CO2 emission that we're doing, because not only because of the predictable consequences, which, you know, there's some uncertainty of those predictions, but it doesn't look good. But then there are the sort of known unknowns and the unknown unknowns that, you know, I don't want to quote Rumsfeld here, but that's a good phrase. We know that there are limitations to our knowledge of the Earth system, and we know that it's possible to reach tipping points. So that's not something we want to mess with, because we only have one planet here. So I don't think it's anything like game over, what's the use? There's nothing that tells me that we're at that state. But I'm also aware that we could at some point be in that state, and that's an important factor in this call for vigilance, that we don't want to go there.
Let me get Andrew and Aranda quite next up on the phones. Go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah, thanks, Evan. This is a really interesting topic, and I appreciated when you were talking earlier about how, you know, when incomes rise, how growth can, or how people tend to have less babies. But I think that until we kind of shift our mindset in the economy around growth, I'm not sure we're going to get there, because, you know, it's seen by a country, if their GDP isn't growing year over year, then it's, you know, a failure, you know, a catastrophe. And so I think that that's an important mindset shift. And then the other thing I wanted to mention in terms of this future orientation is there's a community called Effective Altruism, where they look at, you know, how to best spend your money that's going to have the most, you know, bang for the buck, essentially, for when you're giving charitably. And so some of that is, you know, looking at other countries and how your dollars can go farther and save a lot more lives elsewhere. But they also look at the kind of future orientation, and it's really kind of becomes a cost benefit analysis of, you know, how you value future lives, essentially. If we do something to screw up, what could happen? And so there's a great book called Doing Good Better by Will McCaskill, who's a philosopher somewhere in Oxford or Cambridge in England, that looks at kind of how to put some kind of value on that to try to get people's minds wrapped around that.
Thank you, Andrew. What do you think, David?
Well, I think Andrew's very right to bring up the economic aspects of all this. You know, I'm not an economist myself, but I have heard some people speak about this aspect of it, and been to some conferences where I've heard some economists starting to try to grapple with reality. That I think it seems to me as though basically our theories of macroeconomics are divorced from reality for the most part. They don't include ecological systems. They don't include the finite planet. It's this sort of fantasy set of assumptions of infinite growth. And he's absolutely right. I don't think that the concern about population is necessarily, I mean, these models that show population stabilizing and decreasing do not depend on any change in our economic assumptions. They're just what is happening due to the choices that people make when they come out of poverty. So that's good news. But in terms of the longer run, our assumptions about growth, I think he's absolutely right that we have to there's going to be a reckoning with our having an economy that's just the assumption that health, in terms of a healthy economy, means endless growth. Now, there is this idea of decoupling, that you can decouple economic growth from material output. There are certain kinds of economic activity that don't depend on use of resources as much. But what I don't understand, I'm not sure to what extent you can you completely decouple economic growth from material growth. If not, then we'll still reach some point where our economic assumptions are incompatible with survival on this planet. Ultimately, we're going to need an economy that is sort of more circular in nature. If you think about how nature operates, you know, before we got here, there's all this activity, healthy growth of organisms, everything works its way back through in terms of the material that nature uses. Somehow, we are industrial economic activity.
Hey, David. David, let me jump in. Let me just jump in, because all of a sudden, our connection got really rough with you. So maybe what we can do is just try to reestablish. We can make just sort of reestablish that connection. So while we do that, I'll let our guests on the phone know. Ken, Rob, we're going to be coming to you when we come back with David Grinspoon as we reestablish that connection. And I'll just reset the hour for you. We're talking to an astrobiologist. It's David Grinspoon, and his new book is called Earth in Human Hands, Shaping Our Planet's Future. And the book, as you've been hearing with David all hour long, takes a look at what a real long-term future discussion would be about if we really thought about being a civilization that's going to be on this planet for tens of thousands, maybe even millions of years. And I would just add, Andrew, thought that was a great phone call talking about economic growth. We've said on this program, I think, a number of times that there is a real need to have a truly egalitarian society, not just for justice and fairness, but to address climate and long-term planning. Because if you are struggling, if you are dealing with poverty, I don't think it's quite fair to say to somebody, you know, well, we also need you to, you know, to change your light bulbs and do all those little things. So, David, I was just adding to Andrew's call. We've talked about an egalitarian society is about fairness and justice, but it's also about long-term planning. Because if we have a high percentage of people in poverty, if we've got huge wage gaps, if we've got huge disparities in income, that the people at the bottom of the economic ladder are struggling just day to day. How do you ask them to think about a real long-term civilization, to plan for 10,000-year scales? You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. Hey, you see what happens when I start talking about economics? The machines go haywire. But I think that's right. You know, we can talk in the abstract about our need to limit growth, and it's not just abstract when we talk about long timescales. But at the same time, you're right. I mean, somebody who's just barely feeding their family or feeding themselves, we can't ask them to worry about that. We have a responsibility to help raise their standard of living. And, you know, one of the challenges is that sometimes also means using more energy. So that's one of the challenges with this notion earlier that we should just tomorrow stop all fossil fuel use, because there's a element of that where we, you know, that has implications on the standard of living of people in poor countries. And that's why these problems are actually tricky.
Back to the phones we go, and this is Ken in Rochester. Go ahead, Ken.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. David, first of all, let me say I'm all in, and I'll call myself even a Saganist, if you want to go back that far with Carl Sagan and his lectures and so on, and I totally get what you're saying. My pragmatic question is, who's listening? Who's going to pick up the mantle here, the banner, and is going to go forward? We can't, in today's society, decide who's going to go to the bathroom where. Who on a global scale, for some long-term planning, everybody's looking towards the next election. And I don't care what country you're talking about. So I would like to hear what your thoughts are on that.
Ken, thank you. And David, I'll kick to you with this. I was just thinking about what Ken was saying, and I was thinking, I imagine, let's say we've got a presidential candidate who says, we're going to build the first society that really thinks long term. And they hold your book up at a rally and they say, this is going to be required reading in schools. And we're going to start acting like a civilization that's going to be here for tens of thousands and even millions of years. I would cheer them, and then they would be destroyed by the media and by their opponents for being pie in the sky, lack of realists. And I fear that Ken might be right here. What do you think, David?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard to argue with that in a certain sense. You know, by the way, my parents met each other on a blind date at an Adlai Stevenson campaign rally. And Adlai Stevenson famously was told, sir, you have the vote of every thinking person in America. And his response was, that's not enough. I want to win. And, you know, it's hard to see change at times, especially at a time like this when we seem to be in a period of retrenchment and ignorance. But there's, you know, there's short-term and there's long-term trends. Globally, there's no question that we are making the transformation to new energy systems. It's just a matter of pace. Change is very nonlinear and very hard to see coming. But one thing we have on our side is that reality has a way of coming around and biting you on the backside if you try to ignore it for too long. And for instance, look what's happening in China now. It's not that the Chinese have suddenly become global altruists and perfect democratic society, far from it. And yet the Chinese all of a sudden are getting very serious about solving climate change and changing energy systems. And the reason why is because you can no longer breathe in Beijing without a mask. And there's some days when you just can't go outside in Beijing. They're realizing that they've got a big problem, and they're shutting down coal plants and investing in alternative energy. So, you know, we've got reality on our side, and you can ignore it for a while, but when people see sea level rising and storm frequency increasing and all these other things happening, you know, maybe they'll start listening to the scientists a little bit more. In fact, in some places and in some cases, they already are. And I think that we are moving in that direction of the realization of that we're all in this together and that we need to solve this problem. It's painfully slow, and there's a reaction to that that pushes in the other way, which is sort of how human societies work. So I understand your concern, and, you know, am I 100% confident that we're going to get through this? Of course I'm not, but I also caution against that sort of inferring from short-term trends that in the long run that we are incapable of making this transition.
David, your colleague, Adam Frank, who is a frequent guest on this program from the University of Rochester, recently modified the Drake equation. And you write about the Drake equation in your book. You go back to the 1960s, and Frank Drake put together a kind of rudimentary equation to try to figure out, as best we can, at least a range of possibility for how many intelligent civilizations might exist in our own galaxy. And Adam Frank, with a colleague, recently updated that and essentially concluded that the idea that we are the only technological intelligent civilization in existence, you'd have to believe that the number is like 1 in 10 billion trillion other Earth-like planets where this could have happened and it just didn't. 10 billion trillion is a lot. And Adam doesn't think for a second that is true. And my favorite section in your book, because I love the Fermi's paradox, is the question on where is everybody? And you kind of just remind us of all the possibilities. But for you, remind our listeners, astrobiologists like you, do you think it's even possible that we're alone in this thing?
Well, no, I don't think it's possible. By the way, I'm a friend of Adam Frank's, and I'm a fan of his work, and I really like what he and his colleagues did with the Drake equation. It's just, they basically reframed it, and it's another way of asking this question that with all the worlds out there that we know now are out there, we used to think they were probably out there. Now with the exoplanets, we know how many worlds there are roughly. There's a heck of a lot of them, hundreds of billions in our own galaxy alone, let alone all the other hundreds of billions of galaxies. That's a lot of places where things can happen. And what Adam and his colleagues did was they said, what about all the planets that have ever existed over time?
Yep.
And then you get to even longer numbers. And you get to this, you can sort of reduce it to the absurd, the notion that we are the only life. Even if it's very improbable, even if it's 1 in a million planets that produces life and intelligence, that's still a huge number of planets because there are so darn many millions and upon millions of planets. So when you do the math and you look at the probabilities, you realize that it doesn't have to be very likely on any individual planet for evolution of life and intelligence to happen, that it seems inevitable that there is going to be abundant life and even abundant intelligent and technological life out there in the rest of the universe.
And David's book is just another reminder that our climate challenge is probably the kind faced by so many other civilizations, and it's a question of what we do with it, which leads me to an email from a listener named JP, who says, does David think the TRAPPIST planets are, hold on, JP, does David think the TRAPPIST planets are an effective place that we could end up landing in the future? And the TRAPPIST planets, by the way, we talked about it last week on the program, 40 light years away, can't get there now, maybe we'll have the energy to in the future, but 40 light years away, a small star with 7 rocky Earth-size-ish planets around it, 3 of which might be covered in oceans, and what would you say to JP about going there eventually?
Well, when you say we,
not you and me.
I don't think that JP and I and you are going to go to the TRAPPIST planets eventually. But I would never say never. Humanity someday may travel to the stars. In order to do that, we would have to get over the kinds of more near-term and even far-term problems we've been discussing on this show. But, what's really interesting about the TRAPPIST planets is just the potential for them to tell us about the evolution of other Earth-like planets, that, they're sort of ideally located and oriented so that we're going to be able to observe and discover what their atmospheres are like. And it's just very enticing, and not knowing about another system with all these Earth-sized planets, some of which may be habitable, that is relatively nearby. It's relatively nearby in terms of our ability to observe it. In terms of our ability to go there, 40 light years is pretty darn far. Even the nearest stars, which are about 4 light years, 10 times close, closer are not places where we can easily imagine human beings going. Is, you know, with the kind of spacecraft that we are going to be building anytime soon, one thing I talk about in my book is the notion of a generation ship, which is something in science fiction, which is this well, not necessarily just imaginary, but it's a far future idea that you could build a spacecraft that's large enough and long-lived enough that multiple generations of humans could live on board, and then the descendants of those that set out could reach that star system. Something like that may be the way that humans eventually go to these places. And it's weird to think of being on a journey that is you're setting out and making decisions for your descendants, and you're dependent on the decisions that were made by your ancestors. But if you think about it, that's sort of the situation we're in here on Earth, which is why I like the generation ship metaphor. We are making decisions that our kids and their kids are going to have to live with, and we've inherited a planet that in some ways has been set up by our ancestors, and now we have to sort of learn how to drive the thing. So I think there's, you know, when we think of interstellar travel, we also are forced to think of ourselves as a multi-generational entity on multi-generational journeys, which in fact we are.
Well, I got to say, David, if every political leader read your book, Earth in Human Hands, I think we would have a better future. I hope they do. And I just want to thank you for writing it and distilling things in a way that people like me can understand. I hope our listeners will pick it up. It's Earth in Human Hands, Shaping Our Planet's Future by David Grinspoon. We'll see you on Twitter, Dr. Funky Spoon, and thank you so much for taking the time for this program.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
It really is great stuff. David Grinspoon, our guest for the hour. Thanks for all the great calls and feedback. Got to as many as we could this hour. Has us thinking long term. And I know that's the theme of this program, but let's really think long term if we care about our future on this planet. Thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, Randy Gorbin helping out on the phones this hour. I'm Evan Dawson, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public.